Hello, and welcome to Breaking Protocol. I am your host, Bob Sadowick. The final presidential debate has taken place, and one might say it's all over but the crying, for the loser, that is. But before we get to November 3rd, there's a lot of campaigning to take place. We'll continue to be bombarded with TV ads, opening our mailboxes to find stacks of campaign literature, and opening our front door to campaign lit hanging on our front doorknobs, despite the fact that over one-third of the American voter population from 2016 has already cast a ballot. Today, I am joined by political strategist Sonia Van Meter. Sonia is the managing partner of Stanford Campaigns, a Democratic opposition research group in Austin, Texas. She joined Stanford Campaigns in 2009 and quickly found her professional home. Now in her 10th year in political consulting, Sonia has worked hundreds of campaigns all over the country, including city council, gubernatorial, and U.S. Senate races. In 2013, Sonia became a partner of Stanford Campaigns, where she continues bringing the good word of opposition research to Democratic campaigns and causes for up and down the ballot nationwide. Sonia graduated cum laude from Georgia State University with a BA in sociology, and when she's not digging up dirt on politicians, you can find her enjoying a bourbon, playing bass with her band, or marveling at her husband's latest pun. Sonia Van Meter, welcome to Breaking Protocol.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I'll tell you, I may have to join you on that bourbon run sometime. But, you know, here we are. We're just a few days from electing the next president of the United States. And before I get into the details about your background and your work, how are you feeling about the presidential election?
Well, as a Democrat in Texas, I am by law not allowed to experience optimism. But I got to tell you, you know, all signs point to go on the national level. And so I'm going to allow myself to hope beyond hope that the polls are correct, that voter enthusiasm is, you know, an indicative of the fact that people are looking for change, and that, you know, in the days shortly thereafter, November 3rd, we'll all be looking forward to a peaceful transition of power between 45 and the next president.
Well, we can only hope that all that is definitely on the right path for that to take place. We're going to come back to the presidential election in more detail during our conversation. But for now, let's talk about what you do. Stanford Campaigns is an opposition research firm. Now, tell our listeners what opposition research is and who uses your services.
Sure. Well, if you have watched cool shows like Scandal or The West Wing or House of Cards, I can tell you that opposition researchers are not at all any of that. Despite the fact that Hollywood constantly tries to make us look much cooler than we actually are, opposition research at its core is the examination of publicly available records in order to draw contrasts and launch attacks against political opponents. And I really want to underscore the words publicly available because, and although this has changed a bit in most recent years, at the end of the day, opposition research is really about making sure that we're not wandering into gray area and mucking up public opinion by maybe going after things that shouldn't be a matter of public record. A great example of that is medical records. You know, I know that, you know, in this presidential race, both of the candidates are, let's be honest, they're old. And the fact of the matter is, you know, their medical records are still private for a reason. And when they choose, if they choose, to reveal information about their personal well-being, that is entirely their choice. But, you know, as a society, we agree that certain records should not be made publicly available. Things that are publicly available are things like your criminal history. That I can look up. I don't need special training. I don't need special access or anything like that. Anyone, you know, with a telephone or a Wi-Fi connection can request that kind of information. Anyway, that's a very long-winded way of saying we try to stick to publicly available records because the minute you wander into non-public records, you can get yourself into trouble. And you don't want to get your effort or your candidates you know, into murky territory. So we try to keep everything very much on the level. My firm in particular works for Democrats up and down the ballot from coast to coast. We've done races like school board races and mayoral and city council races all the way up to Julian Castro's recent presidential run. Generally speaking, we do mostly congressional runs for the House of Representatives. And in 2018, for example, we were part of 10 of the 40 red to blue congressional flips. And we're very, very proud to be defending a lot of those same seats this cycle and, you know, in the fight to flip a few more in 2020.
Well, you have to feel pretty good about that record for sure. What is consistently something that is most notable that you uncover when you're researching somebody's background? What's something that's typical that it's always out there?
Generally speaking, I would say, you know, people saying one thing and doing another. And, you know, of course, we generally do most of our research on Republicans. You know, we're an opposition research shop. We work for Democrats. And of course, that means we do research on our Democratic friends to make sure that they know what kind of platform they're allowed to run on and what kind of foundation they're standing on. But it's much more fun to do the research on your opponents. And one of the things that we frequently find is that they sing a very different tune when they are alone. And a really great example of this, you know, happened within the Falwell family when Falwell Jr. was found out to have, you know, had a wife who was cheating on him for long periods of time. And
well, he was kind of playing in the sandbox a little bit too, wasn't he?
Oh, he was certainly playing in the sandbox. And that's exactly the point, though, because, you know, the Falwell family has for generations been beating the drum of one man, one woman, marriage, faithful till death do you part. And it's one thing to build an entire, you know, brand on that, and it's quite another to be exposed for not living up to those values. And that's something that we tend to run across a lot in opposition research, people that talk about, for example, you know, not believing in you know, raising taxes, but who secretly, you know, live very lavish lives and, you know, sometimes have problems, you know, even handling their own tax problems. Or, you know, raising taxes on constituents when they think that maybe they won't notice. You know, it's hypocrisy is I think one of the best things that opposition researchers look for, because it's generally pretty easy to find, and also it's easy to explain to voters. You don't have to walk them through a process. You simply say, this person says one thing and does something completely different. And that's not someone that we can trust to make decisions about our communities.
So when you provide your clients with the finished product, your research, do you advise them on when to utilize it, how to utilize it, or do you just simply hand it to them and go, here you go?
I think it's somewhere in between there. We certainly would never just hand a report to a campaign and say, go and God bless. That is not, I don't think that that's a good way of handling research. On the other hand, when and how to deploy research depends very much on the race. We're currently working in North Carolina 11. It's a Democratic candidate named Mo Davis, who is a 25-year Air Force, retired Air Force, running against a very young first-time candidate, first-time job holder. I mean, he's incredibly young. I don't think he was even old enough to run for office until halfway through his campaign. But, you know, the research that we found on our opponent was considerable, in part due to some depositions that he had been a part of, thanks to a lawsuit he'd been involved in. And, you know, we had this monstrous book. There was so much material, we couldn't wait to find the perfect spot to drop this information. And this was relatively early on in the campaign. And then, rather by accident, it seems like every reporter in the country suddenly got wind of the same things that we did, because about a week later, after we'd finished this report, a series of stories broke on our opponent that, I mean, in truth, it could have been lifted directly from our book. You know, so much of the research that we had found was being told in these stories, which is, you know, the dream come true for most campaigns. So, you know, our candidate never had to go negative by saying, hey, look at what my opponent is doing. Instead, we had journalists from the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and the New York Times, and a whole bunch of local North Carolina venues all talking about this at the same time. Now, I know for sure that I would not have advised my candidate to dump all of that information information, you know, all at once or, you know, all at the beginning, but we'll never know because we never got the chance to. And other times, you know, it's a question of, well, how are we doing? You know, there are certainly plenty of races where candidates are doing so well that it's not in their best interest to go negative on their opponent. You know, you'll be seen as elevating their name when you don't really need to. And also, you know, going negative is sort of it feels a little dirty, even in the era of Donald Trump when everything is sort of sorted. It still feels a little unpleasant to go negative. So, you know, if you don't have to, you don't necessarily want to.
Do you ever, when you, on that point, deliver this opposition research and you're delivering it for a specific purpose, I'm sure you have in mind of how you feel it would be best utilized by your client. And then the client somehow manipulates or misuses that research. Do you ever feel accountable for the outcome of that? Or are you able to divorce yourself from that?
You have to divorce yourself from that. Now, fortunately, most candidates listen, even if they're not interested in listening to their opposition researcher, they're usually inclined to listen to the rest of their consultant team, which includes a media team, you know, a mail team, a digital team, a polling team. And, you know, opposition researchers in terms of the political consultant hierarchy are generally kind of, you know, down near the bottom. But, you know, other consultants who have been in the game for a long time, worked, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of races around the country, will generally back me up, you know, because we all have experience doing this sort of thing. And nobody wants to see a really, really glorious kill shot brought out too early when there's time for it to sort of disperse and get forgotten. And nobody else wants to, you know, at the same time, you don't want to wait until it's too late to capitalize. So there have been times when candidates have gone rogue and, you know, gone ahead and done what they've decided to do, and it didn't really matter what their consultant team would tell them. And at those times, I just kind of go, you know what? I gave you the research. It is all backed up. It is all factually accurate. I can defend with pieces of paper that have been notarized and, you know, come from municipal offices. That, you know, all of this is accurate, but it was your choice, and I work for you, so.
True. I guess at the end of the day, they're paying for the product. Is that how you look at it? Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. I will give them my best advice, and then where they choose to go after that is up to them.
Yeah, let's switch gears here for a moment and discuss the dynamics of campaigns during this global pandemic and how the implementation of running a campaign has changed, which also includes your work, because your work is part of the campaign. What would you consider are some of the most effective platforms during COVID to reach constituents?
I mean, that's a fantastic question. And with the exception of field programs, which are the programs where, you know, campaigns will send volunteers out into neighborhoods, out into communities, and literally knock on doors and say, hi, my name is so-and-so. I represent, you know, the XYZ campaign. I'd love to talk to you for a moment about what we believe. With the exception of those field programs being wildly curtailed or just eliminated, I'm not sure that campaigning has necessarily changed all that much in response to COVID.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because, you know, we've already become a digitally entrenched society. Everyone in some way, shape, or form is extremely online, whether it's through social media or, you know, you're getting your news or you're communicating with your professional colleagues or, you know, you're keeping up with what's going on the other side of the world. You know, everyone's online. So, you know, as long as you've got a screen in front of you, campaigns can figure out how to find you. Sometimes it's through, you know, geolocation on your phone. Sometimes it's grabbing your email address because you respond to something that they have put out. You know, email acquisition programs are still a huge, huge thing in campaigns. Yeah, I mean, as long as you've got a mailing address to send, you know, actual paper literature and an online presence, you know, a screen in front of you, campaigns can find a way to get a hold of you.
Yeah, it's interesting. And even with texting these days, I seem to be getting far fewer phone calls and far more text messages. And I am still personally up in the air on which one annoys me more. So I'm not real.
I can relate. My first few text messages I got, and as a consultant, I'm on everyone's list.
Sure.
The first few text messages that I've got about, hey, have you remembered to vote? Tell three people that, you know, that they need to go vote. You know, have you got your plan? I was like, hey, listen, really appreciate the enthusiasm, but please unsubscribe me. I don't need a reminder every 15 minutes. Now I've gotten to the point where, like, I'm just so tired of it. My phone blows up nonstop all day long. And that's good because, you know, I want the word to be getting out there, but at the same time, there's a limit.
At the same time, you need a glass of bourbon to get through all those text messages.
A big one.
As a constituency, evolve over time. And, you know, there are clearly changes in what voters consider to be front and center issues. But it seems to me that we continue to hold politicians accountable for positions that they once had in the past, instead of giving them credit for evolving and emerging new positions. I mean, is that a valid assessment, or are voters more forgiving than I'm giving them credit for?
I think it depends on the candidate, to be quite frank. You know, a few years ago, when the Me Too movement really kind of reached its pinnacle, you know, there was a conversation about what do we do with the offenders once they've been identified and shamed and shunned from public life. You know, there has to be a way to reincorporate these people, because, you know, one thing that we figured out is that there were a lot of people who weren't fully aware of the fact that they had committed these acts that were, you know, felt as intrusive and harmful and you know, aggressive and assaulting.
Would you say that Al Franken would fall into that category?
See, here's the problem. In order for us to be able to forgive and move on, we have to see some genuine remorse for the decisions that got made. And one of the problems with Franken is that, you know, I believe he never meant to hurt anyone, but I never heard him say, I am really sorry that what I did caused pain. I understand this now because we are far removed from an era where that kind of behavior was appropriate. And in an effort to make sure that this never happens again, here are some steps I've taken to make sure that my community is safe and that these actions are not repeated by anyone else. And here's what I'm doing personally to make amends to the people that I hurt. It's got to be a comprehensive, really well thought out apology. And what we're getting from most of the elites and Hollywood types is an apology if I hurt you. If you were offended, I'm sorry. There's the, you know, the hedging of the bet, which I think people find really, really off-putting. And so anything that Biden can do that puts him in contrast to Donald Trump, that makes him look like a good man, that's something that Biden needs to lean into. And I think that's why he's embraced that so hard. You know, there are plenty of Republicans who are they need an excuse. They need an excuse to break rank. You know, the one thing that I've always deeply admired about Republicans is their brand loyalty. You know, at the end of the day, you know, it really doesn't matter what the candidate is, as long as the candidate adheres to this label, with this label that we've committed to. And, you know, and that's, I think, a trauma for a lot of Republicans who value conservative philosophy and don't see it being executed by Donald Trump. So the more that Biden is able to, I don't want to say stay away from policy. Obviously, he has to talk about policy. But the more he can be out there talking about his personal family values, his love for his children, for his deceased wife and children, for his son with addiction issues, you know, the more he can humanize himself in a way that Donald Trump is simply incapable of doing, the longer a leash he's giving Republican voters who look at Trump and are repulsed but feel strange, you know, going against, you know, what has been perhaps a family tradition for them for generations.
Yeah, you make a really good point. Republicans are very good at falling in line. And there is no doubt this time around, if Biden is to win this election, Democrats are going to have to fall in line. Let's talk about Texas for a minute. You're down in Austin. I'm hearing from multiple Democratic sources that the Texas House is in play. I mean, are you hearing that same prediction? And what races that Democrats in Texas should be focused on the last few days of this election?
So yes, I've absolutely heard that and I absolutely believe it. I am probably not the person to talk to about which races, just because I generally concentrate more on federal and statewide stuff than legislature, at least here in Texas. We haven't done a ton of legislative work, but that doesn't change the fact that, you know, all of the major urban hubs are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Austin, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, they're demographically becoming more diverse. And they're growing. They're growing at an incredible rate. There was a representative in Williamson County, just north of Austin, who became the youngest member of the state legislature recently and was the first Democrat elected to that district, I think, ever, or at least in a very, very long time. And that's one of the districts that I now think is actually pretty safe. And I think that, you know, if you look in the outskirts of those other major urban areas, you'll see a similar phenomenon.
What does the U.S. congressional map look like to you at this point? Can the Dems win the Senate? And what races in that platform would provide them the biggest opportunity?
So in terms of congressional races in Texas, I think Texas 23, which was sort of thought of as the last swing district in the state, it covers a huge area of South Texas, all the way out to El Paso, down to San Antonio, up to the south of Austin. It's been the last true swing district in Texas for a very, very long time. And last cycle, it was the incumbent Will Hurd versus Gina Ortiz Jones. And Gina Ortiz Jones only lost by about 800 votes in an election where more than 200,000 ballots were cast. And Gina immediately decided to run a second time and has an extraordinary cash advantage and looks pretty good, at least in terms of public polling that I've seen, to flip the district. We also have Wendy Davis, who is a powerhouse of fundraising, running in Texas 21, which is an extremely red district, but is currently occupied by Representative Chip Roy, who was the only member of Congress to vote against COVID relief. And, you know, I realize that he is a true conservative at heart, but I think that might be, you know, the straw that breaks this conservative camel's back when faced with, you know, a wave Democratic year with a candidate who is already really well known in Texas and can raise money like nobody's business. And then finally, Texas 22, which is in the Houston suburbs, the Republican incumbent decided not to run for re-election, which opened up a bit of a free-for-all on the Republican primary side. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, once again, we had a candidate who ran in 2018, made a good race of it, learned a whole bunch, and decided to run again. And that candidate, Sri Preston Kulkarni, pretty easily cleared the field, the Democratic primary field, and has a massive cash advantage over his Republican opponent, who is being very heavily propped up by outside groups and other, you know, dark money sources. So I think those are the three races, to Texas 21, Texas 23, and Texas 22, that you're really going to want to pay attention to in terms of House races in Texas. As for the Senate, you know, I think that's anyone's guess, truly. You know, Mark Kelly and McGrath in Kentucky, and I believe Jamie Harrison in South Carolina, all in the final weeks shut down their digital fundraising programs because they had raised so much money nationally that they simply couldn't spend it.
Wow.
Yeah, and if that's not telling, I don't know what is. You know, I think Mark Kelly is a shoo-in. You know, there's nobody in this country that doesn't love an astronaut. He's married to a formerly wildly popular Democratic congresswoman who was beloved. And the person he's running against doesn't have a good history of winning races.
Well, she's actually never been elected, has she?
I know. Yeah. So, you know, I think that there's a tremendous possibility in that state. And as far as, you know, Lindsey Graham, and that's a race that's been nationalized as well. And Jamie Harrison is, you know, he's young, he's vibrant, he's incredibly compelling to listen to. And, you know, he's proven to be very politically savvy. So, you know, I think that's another place where, you know, mathematically, I think the numbers are still sort of stacked against us. But when you take into account the incredible voter enthusiasm that we've seen, the sheer tonnage of first-time voters, of newly registered voters, it's breaking records across the country. And that is generally a bad sign if you're the incumbent. It means people want change. So Yeah, I think Cook has it as 74% chance of Democrats taking the Senate.
So we'll see how it turns out.
I'm going to allow myself a little bit of optimism.
Well, I'm appreciating the optimism. It's nice to talk to the pros who have a positive outlook on things. You know, looking back at 2016, Hillary Clinton lost the election by 77,000 votes in key swing states, or battleground states is what they refer to it as. And Democrats have been lagging behind in voter registration in Florida, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. In fact, Dems still maintain an overall lead of registered voters in many of those states, but many Dems were removed from the voter rolls in Florida and North Carolina because they didn't vote in 2016. So how do Dems overcome this hurdle in those states? And if you were advising the Biden campaign or statewide races, specifically in Florida and North Carolina, what would your approach be? And what would you be telling them to do?
Well, at this point with voting already underway in a lot of the country, there's only so much you can do. You know, voter registration is a moot point right now. But as I understand it, Florida went to some pretty great lengths to re-enfranchise, if that's the word I'm looking for, re-enfranchise people with criminal records who had felonies on their records. And in doing that, I think they gained something like a million new voters that potentially, generally lean Democratic. I think, and Texas has had an extraordinary voter registration program going on with, young people in particular. There's an organization that's committed to registering first-time voters. There are other organizations committed to registering Hispanic voters. There are lots of small-ball organizations. Beto O'Rourke, my God, that man alone has contributed, an extraordinary amount to voter registration and then get out the vote operations. And while no one is ever going to accuse me of being Beto O'Rourke's biggest fan, I absolutely cannot deny that the work he did in Texas in 2018 and the work he's doing now in 2020 is going to have a massive impact on the politics of the state for at least the next 10 years. In his 2018 race, he ran and he demonstrated what can happen when Texas donor dollars stay in Texas. And exactly, what can happen when you go out and actually speak to voters, and not just the voters who vote every time, not just the known registered Democratic voters, going out and talking to young people, going out and talking to low propensity voters, going out and talking to Republicans who maybe haven't heard a Democrat speak to them in 20 years. So, I see efforts, in various parts of the country, but particularly here in Texas, to register, to re-register, to check your registration. My God, I don't know about you, but I'm getting a lot of texts about, have you checked your voter registration lately? Are you sure you haven't been purged?
Yeah, four or five times.
Does your ID match the address where you live now? If so, do you need to update it? Do you know where your polling precinct is? Do you know when? I mean, like the amount of information that's being shoved down voters' throats right now is pretty impressive. So yeah, there are plenty of places where voter suppression has definitely been a problem. Looking at you, state of Georgia, but that's not to say that there aren't more than enough Democrats and people wanting to vote Democrat, whether it's for the first time in their lives or the first time in a long time. I think in a lot of states we're going to find that there are more than enough to cover whatever gaps we might see in polling.
Well, you've been doing this for a long time, and you clearly have, a different perspective than the average voter out there. There is more data on Donald Trump and his nefarious activities, lack of transparency, business failures, just plain old crudeness. And yet, for some reason, there is a solid 40% of voters, no matter what he does, that stick with him. If you were advising the Biden campaign on what key points in the next few days to focus on, what would they be?
That's a big question. I think Biden's done a really good job. Part of the problem with Trump being who he is that, as you said, we know everything about him, and so much of it is deeply, deeply shameful. Whether it's him being bad at business, him being bad at foreign relations, him being bad at, being a patriot and perhaps actually selling out the United States to foreign, bad actors, knowingly or unknowingly, the magic of Donald Trump is that he doesn't care. And when you lack that kind of shame, there's no way for the attacks to really stick. And that's sort of, what has made him, or what made him, I should say, so impenetrable for so long. It wasn't until he started whining. He started whining about how the media was mean to him. He started whining about female reporters asking him tough questions. And then COVID happened. And he treated this pandemic as a personal attack on his job as president. And I think for a lot of people who had looked at him and thought, well, here is our great savior from that, from the disease of socialism, the party of Bernie and AOC, here's our savior. He may not be, the hero we want, but he's the hero that we have. And they're willing to overlook his total lack of morality because, he protected them from the bad guys, but he couldn't protect them from COVID. And instead of empathizing, which is something that Joe Biden does beautifully, because we're talking about a man who has a long history of mourning and being empathetic, Donald Trump went, well, I'm doing great. And if you're not, then that's your problem. Well, how do you tell, the 200,000 families who have suffered a loss, a personal loss during COVID, that this is somehow their problem? How do you tell the millions more who are out of work right now because no one's going to restaurants or no one's going to movie theaters or no one's going to concerts or what have you? How do you tell those people that they're suffering is their problem and not your problem? I think, in these final weeks when people are hurting, when COVID numbers are starting to spike again, when people are worrying about, access to healthcare and, a reliable job market, I think that, Biden's best play is to keep being the loving, supportive, encouraging, hopeful dad that he has always sort of been. We knew him under Obama as sort of like, good time Johnny. He was always the one with the joke, always the one with the memes, always the one with the fun finger point, double gun hellos to people. And you knew him to be a little bit gaffe prone, but you always knew him to be a loving guy. And, someone pointed out to me that, early on during the presidential primary, the Democratic primary, I said, Biden's too old. He's a relic of a bygone era. There's no way he'll survive. Someone said, actually, I think he's the perfect person for this race, precisely because, one, he is from the times that we remember that were good. And number two, he is a world-class empathizer. He knows how to mourn. And right now, the country is in mourning, whether it's, a financial loss of, personal death in the family, or just, bemoaning what the United States used to represent, at least in theory, if not in practice. I think Biden needs to just stay on exactly what he's doing, which is, I see you and I care about you. And I don't care if you're from a red state or a blue state. What I care about is getting you back on your feet, helping you to get past this pandemic, helping you to find access to healthcare that makes sense for you. I think he's hitting the right note as it is.
Well, there is no doubt that the country could use a little comfort at the moment. That is absolutely for sure. And there is no better person in my view. I think we both agree that Joe Biden is the one to provide that comfort. Before we wrap up here today, is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to talk about the last few minutes?
Well, we have talked about this a little bit, but I really do want to emphasize that, for the first time in a long time, everything is up in the air and we don't really know how things are trending because so many of the people that are voting right now have never voted before. Now, generally speaking, that is a bad sign for the people that are in power, the people that already have office, because people are much more likely to vote when they're good and pissed off and they're really, really looking for change. The fact that, more people have voted in Texas as of today than voted in all of 2016 is an astounding fact. And, the fact that there have been voter registration programs going on in swing states, far more aggressive on the Democratic side than the Republican side, is, I think, also indicative of hope, of a general need for change. So if this was a race where you were thinking about maybe not voting because you thought it was already in the bag, or maybe not voting because, you know, you don't especially love either candidate. I would really, really encourage anyone who is registered to vote to please, please don't let this opportunity be wasted. I don't know that a single vote will have ever mattered more. You have no idea how close some of these races come out. Like I said, last cycle, Gina Ortiz-Jones versus incumbent Will Hurd, 200,000 ballots cast, and she lost by about 800 votes.
That's extraordinary insight. Sonja Van Meter, folks, thank you so much for joining me today. The company is Stanford Campaigns in Austin, Texas. And do not allow yourself to be intimidated. Make sure you get out there and you vote. And thanks for listening to us today. If you'd like to hear more of Breaking Protocol, please click and subscribe for notification of future episodes. If you haven't had an opportunity to read my book, Breaking Protocol, Forging a Path Beyond Diplomacy, it's available at your favorite online retailer or can be downloaded to your Kindle, tablet, or smartphone. Have a beautiful day and many blessings.